George Saunders is the author of 9 books, including 10th of December, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and won the inaugural Folio Prize for Best Work in Fiction in English and the Story Prize for Best Short Story Collection. He was on the show with me in 2013 to talk about that. An archive of that show can be found up on our website. I'll give you more information on that later. George has received MacArthur and Guggenheim Fellowships, the Penn Prize for Excellence in the Short Story, and was recently elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. In 2013, he was named one of the world's 100 most influential people by Time magazine. He teaches at the Creative Writing Program at Syracuse University. His latest book and first novel is Lincoln in the Bardo. It's published by Random House, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. George, welcome back.
Oh, nice to be here.
So good. So good to have you back. I've been waiting for this for 3 years, 4 years.
So I'm so excited. I wish I could have written the book quicker.
Well, this was absolutely worth the wait. I'm gonna open just by giving you a few minutes to talk about the book and introduce it, and then maybe we can step off from there. But maybe you can take us into the world of Lincoln and the Bardo.
Sure. Well, you know, I had many years ago, back in the 90s, my wife and I and our kids were in D.C., and one of my wife's cousins just pointed out this graveyard where she said, you know, Lincoln's son really had been buried. And then she just sort of offhandedly threw in this detail that the newspapers at the time had said that Lincoln had actually gone into the crypt, quote, on several occasions to sort of be in some kind of contact with his dead son's body. And that was just one of those things, you know, like as writers, we get those little notions that get into our head. And, you know, at the time I thought, yeah, that's maybe to be avoided. You know, I had a teacher once who said there are ideas that you write and there are ideas that you think about writing. And I thought, well, maybe that's the second category. So I just kind of pushed it off. And partly because it seemed like such a kind of heavy emotional material. And at that time, I didn't really think I could cut it. You know, I didn't have the chops to do it justice. So I just kept pushing it away. And it just kept, over the years, kept coming back. And especially whenever I would be, you know, would have finished another project and be feeling kind of that, you know, like artistic elation that you have, that idea would show up and kind of like, are you ready for me now? You know, so finally, you know, I guess it had been just before we talked last time, I had finished the 10th of December and it was about to come out and it seemed like we were going to get some attention. And so I kind of thought, well, maybe I'll just try it. You know, I'll just concede to maybe wasting half a year or a year on this dead end thing. And then I just started doing it. And one of the kind of, you know, you make these little bargains with yourself. And one of my things was don't even wish for it to be a novel. Just try your best to make it a story. You know, almost like keep a lid on a boiling pot. And at one point, I don't really remember when, but at some point I had like, you know, 50 or 60 pages that I liked and that were kind of, I felt like just the first movement in this larger thing. And then I kind of reluctantly said, well, maybe it's a very short novel. So that's it. And it's kind of basically the night, in my reimagining of it, Lincoln comes to the graveyard on one night. And this is just sort of a maybe 6 or 7 hour period on that night, where really the only observable, you know, action is that he comes into the graveyard and holds the body and leaves. And then, you know, hilarity ensues.
My listeners are probably tired of hearing me ask this question because I often like to talk about the world that books are born into and, you know, that a book kind of holds a place in history and is born in a certain time. And it was really difficult for me in this kind of point in our country's life to spend some, you know, some quality time with President Lincoln to think about who he was, to reflect on him as a man, to kind of reflect on where our country was and what's happening now. And I was just wondering if you could talk for a minute about being with Lincoln at a time when we're so not with Lincoln.
And yeah, we're not Lincoln-esque, are we? We're not.
Yeah.
Well, the funny thing was, I finished this book right before the Trump candidacy happened. I think it had not even been announced yet. And, you know, you sort of finish a book in substance, maybe, you know, in my case, about 6 months or a year before you actually finish it. So yeah. This book is, you know, probably not touched by the literal Trump presidency. I finished it, sent it off, and then I wrote one story, finished a story, and then I went on, and then something was happening and I went on a reporting trip. So it's kind of separate. But yeah. When I finished it, my big impulse was just kind of, and it sounds kind of corny, but it was just this idea of how conditional the country was. You know, you read the Civil War and you can see that it was falling apart. It was not a country anymore. And then kind of also when I finished the book, I looked at our country and I thought, oh my God, this is a work in progress. It's actually kind of a messed up work in progress. It never really, because Lincoln was killed, it never really graduated to take on the issues that the war was about. So it was kind of this beautiful sense that the country, far from being a neatly put away thing, was still developing. And then, you know, history came along and said, yeah, you're damn right. And now we're off to the races, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's just interesting to see where it exists now, when it was written and that separation of time and, kind of the world that it's coming into and being on book tour. I think will be very interesting to be able to, really be able to talk about Lincoln and who he was and what he stood for. And, I think it's kind of nice.
I'm really looking forward to it. Yeah, because one thing about Lincoln, that I came to see was he was a guy. I would say he was somebody who made more spiritual progress in a short time than just about anybody else. When you look at where he was in 1859 and then where he was when he died, he had this series of revelations about human beings and about equality and freedom that were really not only remarkable, and I think we still haven't quite caught up to him, but also, to be coming to him under such duress. The country actually hated him, at the time. He was catching so much grief that he had this personal tragedy. He's making a series of mistakes as president that are resulting in tens of thousands of people, young men being killed, and you'll hear about this by telegram. And so it's kind of incredible. I always think it's kind of Christ-like in a way that he had so much pressure on him. And by any reasonable standards, he was failing and failing at a huge cost. And somehow all that pressure, almost like the way a diamond gets made, it forced him to become this luminous person that we think of now. So it was really a privilege to be around him. But as a writer, I also, to be honest, say that I really didn't want to take him on at all. And I had to kind of make a series of bargains with myself about how to write him. So, if I had ever thought, I'm writing a book about Lincoln, I just sort of, jump off a bridge. But I'm writing a book which has Lincoln in it as a character, five times for short little intervals. It's just sort of like, I think in fiction in general, it's a good way to approach it. You kind of keep moving down the scale of the specific.
Yeah.
So I'm writing about Lincoln. I'm writing about Lincoln on a certain night at a certain time in five discrete incidents, and each time he's sitting in a certain place, having just come from doing a certain thing. Then you can kind of, then it's somehow more manageable and more truthful, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess we should let listeners in on sort of not the secret, but the way this book is structured for people who haven't yet picked it up. So I don't know if you've invented a name for how this novel is structured. It should kind of have a name, but it's sort of a kind of a cool Greek chorus of voices that exist in purgatory, right? I'll let you describe it because I'm going to butcher it probably.
Yeah, it's kind of, all right, so basically, in my practice of being a writer, I have one of these little rules that says you don't do anything freaky unless the emotional stakes of the story require it. So you don't get any points for introducing some innovation just because it should be something that is needed.
Uh-huh.
So in this book, the first time that, something like that happened was, you're going to write a book about Lincoln going to this grave. That sounds pretty good. Who's telling it? Historically, it's just Lincoln showing up. We don't really know what happened, but, he comes in one night, he goes to the grave, he leaves. So first, the first order solution is, okay, it's a long first-person book from Lincoln's point of view. You're like, ooh, that's just a buzzkill. And, one of the principles of writing that I live by is that it's got to be fun. It's got to be at least it's got to feel kind of capacious and energetic. And when you think about doing it, you got to kind of go, oh, yeah, that would be cool, you know. And when I thought about 300 words in Lincoln's head, I'm like, no, like, that does not sound cool. It sounds like you don't want to do it. Mainly because I knew I would screw it up. It wouldn't be any fun. So then you kind of just go, well, all right, so who's in a graveyard at night? And this is where, you know, sometimes I think in the creative process, like parallel tracks cross. So that answer to that question, you know, who's in a graveyard at night? Well, a grave digger, if he's drunk, or ghost. So then I thought, oh, ghost. And then one of the parallel tracks was years ago I started and dropped a novel set in a graveyard where the conceit was kind of like a chat line. You know, all the ghosts were kind of mouthing off at once, and they would interrupt each other, and they would just be a little tagline attribution of whose ghost it was. So those two ideas kind of came together. And then I also had a former student of mine who, in passing, said one day, you know, I think if you ever wrote a novel, it would be a series of monologues. And that really was sort of exciting. So those three tracks came together. So the format is that most of the book is narrated by these ghosts who are lingering in the graveyard that Lincoln visits. And they're lingering kind of because they're stuck. You know, their lives are unsatisfying to them, or they left something undone, so they're not quite able to admit that they're dead and go on to the next thing they're supposed to do. So that was one weirdness of the book. And then along the way, it was kind of like a lot of what I knew about that story that made it moving to me was from history books. Just the, you know, the details around the death of William Lincoln and the way Lincoln and his wife reacted to it and the state of the war and so on. And I, so then the second technical hurdle was, how do you get that stuff in there? And again, after a lot of false starts and obsessive revision, it seemed to me you could slide them in under the same format as the ghost, which was a chunk of text right out of a historical book, just verbatim, with an identifier on it. So the book kind of alternates between these ghosts describing Lincoln and then sometimes these historical sections that kind of set the stage in a more kind of objective way.
So great.
And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I should mention here that it's going to be turned into an audiobook with really quite an all-star cast reading these ghosts.
Yeah, it's all done. I just got the final version. 166 actors. So there's one per every speech in the book, which, you know, I kind of floated to the producer almost in like a playful, experimental way. And Kelly Gilday is her name, and she's like, yeah, we can do that. So she went out, and we got some great actors on it, and we've got my parents on it, and my high school teachers, and
oh my God,
everybody we could wrangle.
That's so great. My guest this morning is George Saunders. The book is Lincoln in the Bardo. It is out by Random House. Bardo is a, we should mention, is a Tibetan phrase, right, for sort of purgatory, limbo.
Yeah, I think it means a transitional state. So there are several bardos. I mean, we're in one right now, which is the bardo that occurs between birth and death. And this book is set in the bardo that happens between the moment of death and, like, your next rebirth.
How much?
So it's kind of purgatorial, but you know, in my Catholic understanding of purgatory is kind of like detention. You know, you have to go and you get out when somebody decides you get out. And this bardo state is a little more experiential, and the people are kind of there, at least in the way I'd imagine it. They're there because they, you know, are sort of unable to face reality, basically. You know, there's that thing in the Gnostic Gospels that says if you let forth that which is within you, it will free you. If you do not let forth that which is within you, it will destroy you. And these are people who haven't really, you know, let out what's within them. So it's possible to get out of the bardo by just, you know, kind of an adjustment of your attitude or of your understanding. Unlike, you know, purgatory is a little more like a jail sentence, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I was curious about your relationship with, I've heard you talk about Eastern religions in the past, and now you mention Catholicism, and I was wondering if you needed sort of, or if this in any way challenged, like, the process of writing this, either challenged or reconfirmed or made you interested in religion, kind of notions of the afterlife, and, you know, kind of some of those spiritual questions.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, it was great to, you know, to go and write every day on this topic that is so huge and is so impossible to really know anything about. And I think what it did was it kind of made me think a little more acutely about the fact that, you know, something happens. You know, I mean, mostly I go through my day thinking, yeah, death, that'll be a drag when that happens to you guys. You know, but you don't think of it as pertaining to you. This material kind of does make you think, you know, and if nothing else, it makes you, it was sort of a form of actively learning, wondering, well, what is it going to be like, you know? And I guess what I came up with, you know, from this, but also from, you know, wider reading, was just that, to me, it would be surprising if nothing happens. I mean, even if it's only happening in the 20 or 30 seconds after you die, it's something happening. It's something extraordinarily different from what we're used to just because the mind is cut loose from the body. So it's intriguing to me, and, I don't have any idea what happens, but part of the notion of the book was that to make that realm genuinely weird. Early on I thought, well, I'll study all these different traditions, and I'll make this bottle look just like the one described in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And then I kind of thought, no, I think if you're trying to mimic or, you know, sort of evoke the feeling of what that realm would be like, it should be genuinely unknown and weird and comic and kind of freaky. Because my guess is whatever happens, it's going to be freaky. It's not going to be like, oh, the pearly gates. You know, but we don't know, you know. So I think that was... Once you get into the book, the book has an idea of what it wants you to do. And in this case, I think the notion was make the afterlife genuinely strange and disorienting, because that's part of the reason these people can't adjust to it, is because it's so not like what they thought it would be. They still believe themselves alive. They still have interactions with the living, and, you know, it's so.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So fun. I mean, I don't know how we tap into the George Saunders magical realism way you do this, but maybe you could talk for a minute about sort of how you did this, how you what your office looks like to keep track of kind of this many characters and kind of their story arcs and how you conceived of, you know, all of these ghosts and how much of their personalities you kind of knew that never really made it onto the page, like how full their lives were in your head, that, yeah. All those questions that are hard to answer, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. My office is a big mess, and that's kind of basically the truth of it. I mean, I think I know about myself and my process that I am always have to be moving, and I have to make all my decisions based on text, like the text is right in front of me. So, for example, when I first thought I was going to try this, I had the notion of getting a big board and plotting everything out. And I know myself, you know, now that I'm 400 years old, I know myself well enough to know that that's a mistake. Like, the pre-planning stuff that I do tends to be limited by my everyday mind. Whereas if I just launch in, sometimes I don't know what you call it, your subconscious or your intuitive artistic self or whatever, that thing is smarter than me. So the trick with this was sort of like balancing that principle, which I know is true for me. I have to go by intuition with the scale. That was really, as you said, that's tricky. So, all I really had was I had a bunch of big white sheets of paper that I'd sketch out short sections, you know, experimentally. And I had a list of the main characters and when they were born and died. And apart from that, it was kind of just... My method is to I reread a lot. Like, I write something and I'll start the next day from the beginning of the book and read through. So it's kind of surprising how much you can keep track of if you're doing that every 2 or 3 days. You know, it's all pretty much alive in your mind. So my thing was, it's always just to trust that the my mind responding intuitively to something in progress is going to be like twice as smart as my everyday mind. So then I kind of purposely try not to control the process too much, you know.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of really cool little surprises that way, you know, things that your subconscious remembers that you didn't, for example. You know, the repetitions will come up, or sometimes a problem that you posed back on page 8 will get solved on page 200, and you kind of even forgot it was a problem. One of the reasons I've just been addicted to writing is that it's a way to every day be in touch with a better part of myself, a smarter, more witty part of myself that I literally don't have access to right this minute. But if you let me write out an answer to this question, and I spend 3 weeks on it, that version is going to be, you know, much more like the person I imagine myself to be. So on a project like this, which is so crazy and big, I guess I sort of saw it as a field test of that principle. Like, could you write a bigger book on these intuitive principles? And I think, you know, I mean, whether it's good or not, I don't know, but it was certainly, you know, possible to finish a book that way. So that was kind of, you know, kind of reassuring. And the only, like, kind of organizational thing it has is just the idea that it's one night, and the time is going to pass in a fairly linear way. So then you have to always be aware of where people are in the graveyard and what they want. And, you know, that gives you kind of a structuring mechanism. But, it's hard to talk about it. It's funny, you know, the process itself is, for me, is so magical and intuitive and also kind of technical in a really pedestrian way. And then when you come out of it on the other side and try to talk about it, you always feel a little bit like, you know, someone said, how did you first fall in love? Like, well, she was really pretty, you know. But somehow the essence of the thing is not really articulable in a certain way.
Yeah, yeah. There's a great video that you did on how to tell a story that I think you can find on... I think it's all over the web, but I think it's also on the Atlantic's website. And your advice there when rendering a character was like, ask the character, you know, tell me something about yourself that would make me love you more, would make me love you better. I thought that was a great way to open a character up that, you know, the more you tell me about you, the more I'll either empathize with you or I'll understand you or, you know, it's great when you're stuck, I think.
I think so, because, you know, and mostly I think we get stuck because we want to sort of make a character and have them stay where we put them, you know. And often, I think for some reason, that takes the form of making someone who's slightly more reprehensible or villainous or stupid than we are. And so, and I think that maybe it's just an okay first step, and that maybe is how we do it. But then there's a second move that you can attain in revision, which is, just as you say, to look at the character and go, in whatever form works for you, to say, you know, I have a feeling I'm not quite doing you justice, you know. I did a piece for the New Yorker where I went around to these Trump rallies, and that approach works there, too. I go in, I'm talking to somebody who's a Trump supporter. I'm not for Trump. So I'm kind of looking at that person with a slightly suspicious or jaundiced eye. You know, I'm almost like ready to cherry pick something and disagree with. But you can catch yourself at that, and then you can say, wait a minute, you know, what was the happiest day in your life? I don't think I'd ever ask that literally, but you say something to disarm them, but also to disarm your own projections about them and try to get talking in a different wavelength. And I think if your goal as a fiction writer or a journalist is to know the whole truth, the whole message truth, and sort of like at least for a couple seconds be comfortable sitting there in the face of these contradictions and these parts of the truth that you don't really want to admit, if that's your goal, then the more data, the better. You know, even if some of the data is false or contrived, or, you know, it's that kind of holy moment where you go, okay, I really want to hear the whole truth here. And then it comes flooding in on you, and there's, I mean, in my case, the reaction is often anxiety and a kind of a panic to want to get back to my viewpoint, you know, get back to my familiar liberal self. But I think it's almost like taking a really cold shower or like staying in a freezing waterfall. You can't do it for very long, but it's really good for you, you know. Yeah. So for me, all of the stuff I write, I think that's kind of, it's all a form of that same thing of trying to get out of my stupid, you know, kind of rigid way of seeing things that gives me such comfort because it's so familiar to me and it flatters me so much, you know, to break that shell somehow and just for a little bit of time be truly open to the world. And that happens sometimes formally. Like in this book, there's a moment where it was really fun for me and surprising. Lincoln is, it's near the end of the book, and Lincoln is thinking about what he's learned on this night where his son has died, and unbeknownst to him, he's been possessed by hundreds of ghosts. And he basically makes a speech that I really believe in, which is this idea that, you know, what unites us here in this world is that we all are so sorrowful. We have so much suffering. Even a perfect life has so much suffering because it ends in death. And so he's feeling this, like, wow, you know, that's a good way to look at humanity. Everybody is a suffering being, you know. So I'm writing this, and I'm feeling very good about it, because Lincoln's agreeing with me, basically. And then I kind of look up, and I think, oh, yeah, wait a minute. This is 1862. You know, Shiloh's coming up, and you know, Antietam, and getting, you know. So this guy is going to have to go out and direct the murder of hundreds of thousands of people. So at that point, that's where your conceptions suddenly have outed you a little bit. And artistically, the answer is to go, okay, and put it in there. And so at that point, the book swerves, and he has that exact same thought. So I kind of live for those moments where my, you know, this guy who's talking to you and is so limited and dopey gets to be in touch with something a little bigger than himself.
Yeah. It's also interesting to hear you talk about revision and going back through this over and over as being, I think you've talked about it before, as being sort of an act of love, and like kind of love in progress, and understanding more and deeper, and that this character, ideally characters would just be you on a different day, I think is something you've also said. To separate out this, you know, the other or the villain, or, you know, this guy that isn't me and I couldn't be like this guy. It gives you such an act of empathy for these characters. It's great.
Yeah.
And it's really funny.
I've been thinking lately about the limit to that, too, you know, because you think there are probably people in the real world who, on whom you're, well, I'm not sure. The question is, are there people in the real world on whom that kind of empathy is wasted? You know? There's that moment where it morphs into what the Buddhists call idiot compassion, where you're, you know, with your head tilted and a look of concern on your face, you're fretting over somebody who may be, you know, is or isn't convertible. I'm not sure how I feel about that. I actually don't believe that. I think it always makes you better if you at least try to do that. But sometimes, you know, it's certainly the case that kind of tendency can be enabling, I think, for certain kinds of harshness and cruelty.
What surprised you the most about this? What did this project kind of reveal to you that came out as the most interesting, the most surprising?
Well, you know, the one thing that was, you know, sometimes I think a book is kind of, or a story, is kind of defined by the constraints it puts on you. And almost from the first lines of a story, you can feel the constraints kind of humming around you and saying, okay, this is a particular story with particular rules. In this one, I mean, one of the obvious ones was that I couldn't use contemporary diction, which is something I love to do. And I love jargon and corporate speech and all that. So one of the big challenges was, you know, it's 1862, so certain patterns of speech, if I use them, we're gonna puncture that illusion. So that meant that one of my, you know, my probably better gifts had to be set aside. And that was weird, you know, it was hard, and the hope is that something else will rise up in its place, you know, and so what rose up in its place was that I got to use, you know, that kind of elaborate 19th century diction, which you don't use that much anymore, and it was really fun, you know, to play with that over those 4 years and get better at it and read a bunch of historical texts and have those languages in your head, and then to find out that really florid kind of high-tone language, it actually gives you access to stuff that you couldn't get at in a contemporary diction. That was kind of interesting. And then somehow associated with that, there are moments, I think, of more straightforward emotion in this book than in my stories. It's you know, it's a father's grief and so on. And so just to kind of, like, tiptoe up to that material and go, okay, is there a way that I can straightforwardly take on, you know, a father grieving for his son, and try to stay this side of maudlin and still be accurate and still make the language kind of fun and beautiful and evocative. And so in a way, it was almost like if you were someone who wrote for the string quartet and someone said, okay, now I want to commission this, but you have to use, you know, a different set of instruments. Maybe an accordion or something, or, you know, or maybe vice versa. You know, you wrote an accordion and someone gave you access to an orchestra. It's just kind of a nice way of, if you're like me, I feel like I have a very, very narrow wedge of talent that I've been using. And this is to give yourself a constraint is a good way of investigating the places you maybe haven't stepped into yet. You know, so that was fun. And it had thematic payoffs. I mean, the book has, I think it's, you know, I felt like I, certainly as writing it, I got into emotional ranges that I hadn't been in before. So that's kind of nice.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was really happy to see your signature humor all over it because I thought, oh, a book about, you know, taking place in a cemetery about Lincoln who just lost his son. How funny could that be? However, it turns out pretty funny, actually.
Well, it's interesting to say. I had the same thought. And, in fact, there was early stuff, you know, where I was kind of working and I was reading and I'm like, oh, my God, this is not funny. There's something of me missing in it, you know. And so then it's kind of like that riding a bicycle idea. You know, if the draft feels too serious and maudlin, then you can leaven it with something else, you know. And for me, that kind of, it also tied in with this idea that, you know, for me, when I look at the world with this question of is it tragic or comic, I mean, the answer is, yeah, it is, you know. I mean, there's the whole idea of comedy, I think, comes out of this notion that most of the time we're only telling part of the truth. And when the truth comes in from a strange angle, it's funny. You know, if somebody, you know, there's a beloved person who's passed away and we're all gathered at the funeral and you fart. But it's funny because of course it could happen. Well, of course. We make a construction of the world that says, oh no, this is a somber occasion. And likewise, you know, if you were in a funny situation, you know, you're having a water balloon fight while dressed as a clown and you get hit by lightning. You know, so the reason we make the distinction between the comic and the tragic is that it's kind of nice to think that the world is only comic or only tragic. But with this book, you know, I kept thinking, well, the fact that you're dead doesn't mean, you know, you could still be full of shit, which is always funny, or you could still make a mistake, which is always funny. So it's kind of fun to, like, but again, you know, it's always in the text. The text is the thing that tells you that. You know, you're writing something that's, you know, you're imagining your reader and you feel they're starting to doze off because you're being so historical. Well, then, you know, you might have an occasion to wake her up by doing something kind of fun and vice versa.
Yeah, right. Did it make you feel better or worse about death? Did it make you more afraid or less afraid of it?
I think about the same. I'm trying not to think about it. No, yeah. I mean, you know, I guess the one thing that I came away believing in even more is that, you know, whatever happens to us over there, it's probably not unrelated to what we're doing right now. So, you know, if you accept the kind of the Tibetan model, you know, we have all these habits of thought and the habit of mistaking ourselves for being identical with our thoughts. And then at the moment of death, some of these texts say, you know, your mind is like a wild horse released from a tree it's been tied to. So whatever habits of mind you have now, they're just going to get supersized in death. So that's both terrifying, you know, because I know the way my mind works and how much I cling to it. But it's also kind of reassuring because it indicates, you know, that if we did some work now in this realm, we'd be in better shape there. And in fact, some of the texts also emphasize that the when you're in the human sort of embodied realm, it's like crunch time. That's when you can make the most progress on spiritual issues because you're encumbered with the body. So, you know, I think for me, it was mostly the book was helped me understand or helped me remember that something's going to happen, you know, at the end of your life. And even if it's just fade to black, any effort we make on this side to prepare ourselves for that is going to actually lead to a more interesting, enjoyable life right now. So in that way, it's not really morbid. It's kind of like, well, yeah, I mean, I'm obviously, you know, the fact that I'm, you know, a little pudgy and bald and my memory is growing would indicate that there's some changes going on in me relative to when I was 8. So if I project that ahead, yeah, I guess I probably am going to die. But that doesn't mean this isn't still a party. You know, it's still a party, and it's just a party, and we know what time the police are coming.
I found myself reading this thinking, you know, kind of the what would George Saunders do, WWGS, and I'm like, oh, I guess I should probably be a good human now. Maybe there is a possibility.
I'm guessing if you had that thought, you already are. But But it's interesting, too, you know, to sort of to be in the time we are now politically and see that being, you know, a good person is maybe more complicated than we thought. You know, that, and I look back even to the, you know, those golden years last year when, you know, you felt like you're kind of free to try to be nice to people around you and become more mindful. And then, you know, all these big changes in our country. And I think regardless of what side of the political aisle you're on, the sense that this is all, this great country is conditional and could go wrong in many directions is kind of spooky. And I think it makes me think that it's kind of easy to be a facile moralist, which I consider myself. And now we're in the kind of heat zone where, as was the case with the Civil War period, you know, where you can say, I believe in freedom for everybody, and I believe slavery is an outrage. And then that means you might have to go to Gettysburg and get ripped in half by a cannonball, you know. Or you can say, you know, I believe that slavery was willed by God, and then a bunch of people from the north are going to come down and kill you and rest your... So it was a time when the easy moralisms that had been in play even a few years, you know, 1856, 57, suddenly were in a really quickly escalating fashion being put to the test. And then I think you know, you get into a whole other realm of trying to figure out what morality looks like and what kindness looks like and what, you know, political engagement looks like. And so I think we're getting just a little taste of that now.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have time for one more question on that topic?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I want to be respectful of your time, but, but, you know, I think what's coming up a lot now, and I keep vacillating between telling myself that, you know, art is more important now than ever, and then thinking, you know, every minute that I'm not out resisting and I'm just making stuff up on my computer, I'm wasting precious energy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just love, and Danny Shapiro kind of came out with some interesting topic on that, but it's gotten me thinking of, you know, kind of why write, why get back to work in the face of all this? What does it matter when the world is burning to create art? And no better person to address that than you, I think.
Yeah, well, I just, first of all, yeah, 100%. That's a huge booming question right now. I'm answering it in different ways. One is, I think everybody in this mode has to do what they do. You know, if you're an angry person, be angry. If you're a compromiser, compromise. If you're a writer, write. So that's one thing. I think we can't, you know, there's no... that's the way of maximizing resistance energy is for everybody to do what they want, you know. The second thing I thought is that, you know, it was funny to come out of this book in that kind of beautiful state where you're, like we've been talking about, you know, you're involved in this really complicated, ambiguous symbol system that you're making, and you're becoming aware of how much there is in you that doesn't normally get expressed. You know, in other words, you're a much more expressive, articulate person than in writing than you are in real life. So to come out of that and then go jump right into the political scene by going on those Trump rallies and then coming back and, of course, you know, like everybody getting, you know, over my head and the internet and all that kind of stuff. It really struck me the difference in those two modes, the artistic mode versus, let's call it, the social media mode. Those are like emanations from two different species. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I'm thinking about art is it's really important that those of us who like it and are good at it do it at the highest possible level, if only to remind ourselves as a species that that higher mode of communication is possible, you know, is accessible to us. It's a little bit abstract, but in a time where our discourse is getting so degraded and Orwellian and weird, and also on both sides combative and crude and, you know, abusive, I think it's really important to keep a kind of a sacred chapel where these high-level manifestations of human intelligence can still exist. So, you know, you think about other this crazy political stuff versus a Shostakovich string quartet. Well, I don't know if that string quartet is doing anything, except one, it humanizes the listener, but also it occupies a space to remind us that human beings are more than just argumentative, political snark, you know. In other words, it's almost like if you were, if you were stuck in a little, you know, closet your whole life and you could look out and see somebody energetically doing yoga, you're like, okay, so this body that right now feels to me so constrained and doomed actually has that potentiality. I think that's a valid thing. And I think, you know, as somebody who's been in arts for a long time, I noticed the last couple months that I have kind of, my attitude towards art has kind of been a little bit condescending. I think I've treated it as, yeah, this is what I do, but basically it's an ornament. It's not the real thing our culture is interested in, but thanks for tolerating it. And after this, I'm thinking, no, actually, that's a real mistake. It's the main thing that people do. You know, making scale models of the world that are intricate and are faithful and are loving and are ambiguous. That's really the thing we have to do first before we decide what to do. And I don't think it's a coincidence that in a culture where the arts have been allowed to shrink and be marginalized, that this kind of weird political space is occupied. It's almost cause and effect. You kind of sideline complex expression. Well, simplistic expression is going to think better of itself and kind of start to dominate. So I'm actually, you know, more in love with art than I've been maybe in my whole life right now, which is maybe paradoxical.
Mm. That might be the best answer ever I've ever heard. You know, it's... Well, and I do think that one wonderful way to garner empathy is through fiction. You know, I mean, that is what it is creating empathetic feelings for people who are not you. And don't we need that right now?
Yeah. And I think, too, you know, part of it that I've been struggling with is I always had in my mind that part of the function of art was persuasive, that you would write a book and then somebody with whom you didn't agree would read it and be persuaded. I'm not so sure it happens. But when I was on the Trump rallies, there were a lot of people who just weren't really engaged in that kind of thing. And so I'm kind of thinking, well, that's still a nice thing to believe in. But as you're intimating, it also helps the writer empathize more. Mm-hmm. You know, so even if all you're doing is softening up your perimeter a little bit through working on this imaginative project, that's a pretty big thing. You know, if you had... if everybody in the country or half the country was 20% more willing to engage with the other, more empathetic, that would be a real huge improvement.
Yeah, yeah. I was so grateful that you went that you did that article so that I didn't have to go to a Trump rally. I felt like I kind of felt like I'd been there. I'd done enough.
It was really. I think I started it thinking it would be one rally and it would be kind of like. I think, you know, back then in the spring, it was kind of almost like being presented as kind of a sideshow, you know, like a little strange thing that was happening. And then to get there and go, wait a minute, these people are pretty nice and they're not fanatics. You know, that was really challenging, you know, to try to kind of go, all right, so obviously this isn't, you know, as we found out later, it's not a fringe movement. And then to try to adjust your vision of America accordingly. And for me, you know, too, to kind of be interviewing people who weren't used to being interviewed, and to not throw them under the bus was a big challenge. So it was a great moral exercise to try to figure out where my limits are. And if somebody who, you know, is always espousing empathy, what does that mean? You know, if somebody's, like I would go one day to talk to immigrant groups who would tell me about all the degradations, this was in Arizona, all the degradations that even Mexican-American citizens are going through every day because of these racist ideas. And, you know, you feel such sympathy, and then you go meet some very nice person who'd come over from California for this rally and was always talking about assimilation and how I'm not against immigrants, and you see that the relation between harm and the causer of harm is really complicated. This person would never have, you know, abused an immigrant, but they were out in support of this movement that seems based on abusing immigrants. So, you know, again, just to sort of, I think one of the great gifts of, you know, life, especially as you get old, is to have your constructs torn down. And that whole trip was just like one thing after the next, confusing, you know. Somebody like me who's kind of from a basically working class environment, and then you're hearing that this is a working class movement, that you're meeting people who don't seem like they're working class, and you're meeting other people who definitely are, and there's this overlay of right-wing media hysteria. And it was, I mean, you come out of one of those things, you're so blessedly confused, you know.
I would imagine this will make for amazing fiction fodder in the future. I mean, you can't have gone through that experience without all this stuff in your head of needing to come out in some sort of, you know, organized literary way some way down the road.
I hope so. I just, you know, right now it's so close that, you know, you keep thinking, okay, so in the story there's a Trump supporter and a Clinton supporter, and that's not going to work. So what happens with me is it percolates and it comes out in something. It'll come out in something else about which I've decided will have nothing to do with this, and then it'll still kind of tumble out from the subconscious. But, yeah, the deep stuff, you know, and I remember after 9/11 thinking, how in the world do you write fiction? You know, it's almost like if you're in a house and the roof is coming down, and you're writing a, you know, a nice love story. You're like, how can I write a love story when this stuff keeps falling on my desk? But we can, you know. I think part of it is what we talked about earlier. I think if, as artists, if we say, we almost kind of like human up and go, wait a minute, art is really important. I might not be able to understand why it is right now. It's certainly not the case that my book is quote unquote relevant, maybe, or, you know, but it's just the act of doing something beautifully. It can't be irrelevant to this stuff. There's no way it can be. Then go on that assumption that, you know, putting your heart and soul into something at which you're skilled, treating that object with loving kindness and with a lot of attention, it's gonna cause a good effect in you, and, you know, maybe cause a good effect in the reader. If it has to do with politics, maybe we don't get to know that. You know?
Yeah.
But in the same way that if you get to do, you know, a thoughtful thing on the street, that's a good thing to do. Now, does it affect the politics? Yeah, maybe. You know, maybe incrementally it does in some way. But I don't know. Also, you know, the truth is, as I'm sure your listeners and yourself know who are writers, in a certain way, you got to do it. And if you're good at it, you're going to do it. Even if somebody could prove to you that it wasn't making a difference, I think we would still do it.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so, too. I hope so, too. Was there something we should have talked about that we didn't?
No, I'm not that. We covered a lot of ground.
I feel like we did. Yeah, I feel like we did. Is there any advice that you give out? I mean, we've given a lot of advice here today, but I don't know if there are things you tell your students routinely that that we didn't share today.
Well, the one thing I've learned from teaching so many great students is that, one, the goal is for them to do the thing that only they can do. You keep your eye on that. That's really the goal. So that's going to mean accepting a lot of things about yourself that maybe you don't like, or maybe you have been trying to suppress. And it's probably going to be the case that your book will be somewhat like you in some surprising ways. The charms that you use to get through every day will somehow be manifest in the book. That's the one thing. And then the second thing for me, anyway, and I don't think this is universal truth, but for me, it's been the case that all the answers, all the questions and the answers are on the page. I get to the problem of a book and I get to the solution of it by writing and writing and writing, obsessively rewriting. So I find that any worry I do off the table is probably not that useful. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was a great thing to come to understand, because it lessened the stress about it. You know, instead of thinking, oh, I have to gain this book, or I have to figure out in advance, or I have to be smarter than I am or different than I am, it's just, no, just sit down and work on it, and it'll tell you. It'll tell you what it means. It'll tell you where you're wrong. So then that has a sub, kind of a sub-lesson, which is the whole craft is really about a person getting in touch with their taste. And that has a sub room, which is, okay, if I put a sentence in front of you, young writer, do you have a feeling about it? And anybody who's, you know, in grad school has huge feelings about it. I mean, amazingly contentious feelings about it. You can have get a great fight going in a room of students by saying, which version of this sentence is better? You know? So to me, it's a relief to say, all I really pray for is, please, God, let my taste stay active and prickly and opinionated. As long as I have that, I'll know what to do, which is start to revise that one single sentence. And then the whole thick of world comes out of that. The day that I'm dreadfully afraid of is the day that my taste goes away, and I don't care. Sentence A is the same as sentence B. That would be the end of it for me.
Yeah, yeah. Which is a great argument against the worry of some MFA programs where people are afraid that, you know, they churn out people that sound the same. To stick to your own voice is critical.
Yeah. I don't really see that as a as a problem. You know, I don't see this sounding the same as a problem. I think the one potential problem is that, you know, there's that assumption of consensus that a workshop has. You know, we're going to get together and talk about your story, and we are going to adjust you. And I think that's okay as long as that doesn't happen too much. You know, people who are in workshops for 9 or 10 years, I think I wouldn't advise that. But if you get into 2 or 3 good ones that teach you about your kind of habitual bad moves and kind of gives you access to some of the low-hanging fruit that you can fix easily, that's really good. And then I think, you know, to go off by yourself is really, you know, that's really important. It's not a consensus project, except it can be for very, you know, a very short window in a writer's life, I think.
Yeah.
But then programs also, you know, they're like football teams. I mean, they all have the same idea, but they execute the ideas differently. So that's, I think, for young writers to kind of look, you know, if you can visit or you can talk to current students, just to see the way that the program rhetoric actually gets put on its feet is really important. Because everybody, you know, everybody says the same thing, but how does that get actualized is really the main thing. And I think also, you know, how much are you paying for it? That's pretty important.
Yeah.
To come out of a program with $80,000, $90,000 debt is, I would say that puts the wrong emphasis on the what happens next. You know, you get to get bills to pay.
Yeah, no kidding. Right. Never heard an MFA program compared to a football team. I like that. I'm going to use that.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
We were getting uniforms made up of two.
Yeah.
You get the elbow patches, you know.
The helmets. You definitely need a helmet.
Yeah, very light helmets. Yeah.
George Saunders, this was as much of a pleasure as I knew it was going to be. Thank you so much.
Oh, for me too. Thank you so much.
Thank you.